Ego whack, we're on.
Thanks, Richard. Well, good morning, brothers and sisters. I seem to be doing talks on creation and evolution a lot at Coventry East, so I thought I'd do something completely different. No trouble is, I forgot about last night, which is all about prophecies concerning the Lord's return. So those of you here last night, I'm sorry, we're looking at Ezekiel 38 today. And I thought I'd spare you the chapter, and I hope all of you have got some familiarity with that amazing chapter. And we're going to go through, I've got a signpost there, because if we were looking at Ezekiel 38, say in the year 1900, there was no signs of it coming to life. Nothing there to indicate that it was soon to be fulfilled in any way. 1980s, I won't go through the eight right now, but there was eight signs showing that the return of the Lord Jesus was near. And there's a good many of us in the room here would have been aware of those eight signs. But amazingly, I would say now, there are 17 signs in Ezekiel 38 showing that the return of the Lord Jesus is near. So we're coming to a wonderful crescendo, really, wonderful time of the Lord's appearing. Ezekiel 38 in many ways is depressing, because it's all about warfare, it's all about a terrible battle. Not a great thing to be looking forward to, but you know, we have to look beyond Ezekiel 38. There has to be an Armageddon, but once Armageddon's done and dusted and the Lord takes control, then the tides move back, the waves of wickedness roll back, and peace ensues. So that's what we're looking for. Now, a key thing about Ezekiel 38, that as well as Israel being at its heart, then you have Russia there predominant. And I've actually got six identifiers that Ezekiel 38 talks about Russia, but I'm only going to show three this morning because of the time. But I've actually got three more up my sleeve. We'll look at the three that I think are fairly clear. So if you've got your Bibles open at Ezekiel 38, and I promise we're not going anywhere else other than Ezekiel 38, but if you look at verse 3, we read and say, this is the Lord speaking to his prophet, "Thus saith the Lord God, behold, I'm against thee, O Gog, the chief prince of Meshech and Tubal." So the prophecy is directed to these nations and to Ezekiel and his day and generation. He'd have some idea where Meshech and Tubal was, obviously. But for us, we have to look up as to where those people lived, yes, but also where they spread. So it's a different challenge for us trying to determine how this applies. But the interesting thing is, in the AV, we've got the word chief, which in all modern translations, modern translators choose to leave it in the Hebrew, which is Rosh. So I've got a little list there, starting with the Revised Version. We could read the latter part of verse 3 as the Prince of Rosh, Meshech and Tubal. And whether they're biblical scholars or otherwise, just historians, the idea of Rost leads us straight away to Russia. There you go, 1640, that quotation. And again, I've got another quotation there. So there isn't much argument that Rosh deals with Russia. That's an identifier. So that's, for me, the first identifier, perhaps the easiest in Ezekiel 38. To give you another one, in that list in verse 2, we've got Tubal. I'm going to overlook Meshech for now. But we've got Tubal, and again, relatively easy. The map might be a slightly different orientation to what we normally expect in the West, but if you look at that map there of Russia, then in Siberia, as it happens, is Tobolsk, and you've got the River Tobol. So it's linguistically, if nothing else, it's got a strong link there with Tubal. So that's my identifier two. And third one is very easy, really, in terms of the direction, because in verse 15, if you scan your eye down at verse 15, It talks about this confederacy led by Gog, and it says, thou shalt come from thy place out of the north parts. And you look at the map of the Middle East, and look where Israel is, see where Russia is in relation to it, then, you know, Moscow's virtually in line, really. It's incredible. So there we have them. And again, you look at the RV, it talks about the uttermost parts of the north. So we're not just talking about Turkey here. And so there's three identifiers. You know, we could look at Meshach, we could look at the other names there and so on, and even the two-headed eagle that represents the Romanovs, and now even the modern state of Russia has got a bearing on the Middle East. But we'll leave that be. I'm hoping that's enough just to reassure us again that we have here, and those opening words of Ezekiel 38, reference upon reference to what we know today is the Russian power. And so, as I've already said, I'm just going to put it up there on the screen. Incredibly, you know, we can be so bold to say this from a biblical point of view. People think the Bible's irrelevant. You know, well, we're going to be really up front and say, you know, let's look at Russia. Let's look at Ezekiel 38, and this is what we're saying. Most people probably laughed to scorn on that front, but so be it. We'll have a look at the other signs anyway. Come down to verse 8. We know of this Gogan invasion, but the Lord says there through his prophet, and after many days thou shalt be visited, in the latter years thou shalt come into the land that is brought back from the sword and is gathered out of many people against the mountains of Israel. And you know, this is truly remarkable. It's probably the first thing that really struck me when I started to get interested in the Bible and started to come into contact with Christadelphians, was the fact that Israel, the Jews, exists. That the nation of Israel has come into being after 1900 years of the Jews being scattered throughout all the world. They have been gathered out of many people. You know, they can't speak of it like that with other nations. Just not on that scale. It's an incredible scale. Spent the time, the geography of it all, everything. The improbabilities of it all. The different languages that may or may not be a problem. All those sorts of things all have been overcome, and it's happened. They've been gathered out of many people. So that's sign one, because you didn't have that in 1900. And we had it in 1980. But even more so than 1980. There's more Jews there now than there were in 1980. And then we come down to verse 16. And thou shalt come against my people Israel as a cloud to cover the land. It shall be in the latter days, and I will bring thee against my land, that the heathen may know me, when I shall be sanctified in thee, O Gog, before their eyes. Now, I put in red and underlined again the idea of the latter years or the latter days, but my sign too is my land. Because it's one thing the Jews being gathered together to form their own state, is another thing as to where they do it. In the early 1900s, there was great discussion that they could be set up in Africa or even in South America. You know, even Adolf Hitler did the crazy scheme in terms of getting rid of this Jewish problem by actually shipping them all to Madagascar. He was going to make Madagascar an island just full of Jews. And then when others are around him, so it's actually going to be difficult to get them there. Let's just do an easier solution. They did something different, which we all know about. There's all that happening in terms of gathering them together. All sorts of countries, all various parts of the world. I say even Madagascar got a mention at one point in the most unpleasant way. But it's Israel. It's the right land. They come back into the right land. So there are two strongest points, I think, of all that should make us sit up and say, come on, Ezekiel 38, this is fascinating. This actually has got a bearing on what's going on today. And Israel's forever in the news. The land's always before us. The people are always before us. And we read in verse 4, the Lord says to Gog, I'll turn thee back and put hooks into thy jaws, and I'll bring thee out and all thine army. There's a lot in that verse. But that idea of turning back is intriguing. Putin and the head of the Russian Orthodox Church have become really close, particularly in more recent years with Putin's regime. He's been there a long time now. But in recent years, him and the leader of the Orthodox Church have been close. Putin has had friendly discussions with the Pope, with Francis. Now, what I'll put this to you. I'll put it to you because when Russia was involved in the Middle East before the collapse of the Soviet Union, it was very much a communist state. There was no religious angles on it at all. I mean, if Stalin had his way, there wouldn't be any religion. All the churches were smashed. But by and by, when the Soviet Union collapsed and Russia had to just look to its own problems, of which there are many and still there, their external policy, their foreign policy, took a different order altogether, and they withdrew their horns, as it were. But now they've come back into the Middle East. They've come back. You know, they're not discouraged by the woeful circumstances they had in Afghanistan in the 80s or anything like that. They're going in there big time now. But when they do so, they've got a religious element to it, because we read in verse 7, "Be thou prepared and prepare thyself, thou and all thy company that are assembled." And the word company and the word assembled in the Hebrew are one and the same. And it's got the idea of gathering together for religious as well as political reasons. And so when Russia moves forward in whatever capacity, then it looks for the blessing of the church. That's what's going on now. In the days of the Soviet regime, never looked in such a manner, but now they do. Putin wants to take the church with him. Russian Orthodox, Roman Catholic, if possible. So that's an interesting sign, that. I will turn thee back. And so they've come back. They're coming back into the Middle East, but they do so in a different way to what they've done before. Certainly I wouldn't imagine that in 1980. And verse 4, we'll concentrate on that and put hooks into thy jaws. Well, that's easy, really. They're getting pulled down with various purposes. They're looking to have an influence in the world. And we see them militarily coming into Syria and getting heavily involved in Syria. Syria is a hook, bringing them down to the Middle East, bringing them down to the very borders, really, of Israel. It's amazing. And that's happened just in the last 18 months or so, right down to the borders of Israel, and the West has allowed them to do it. Hooks, plural, because whilst I'm putting to you there a picture with Syria and mentioning Syria, Ezekiel 38 talks about the hook of all hooks, which is Israel itself. So that's sign number 4. And we read there, "I will bring thee out and all thine army." And the Soviet Union had quite a fair bit of military hardware. Most of it went to rust. But the new state of Russia under Putin is getting very sophisticated. And the build-up is going at an alarming rate. You know, these just some pictures out of many you can glean easily off the internet. They're really putting a lot of effort. And that's my sign 5 in terms of the military hardware. And I've just literally taken this off the internet this morning, because this last couple of days the Russians have built up their troops in Ukraine, and whilst they've got on their 40,000 massed on the border, they reckon this last week it's now up to 55,000. And so there's a bit of interest as to what Putin's playing at, and is he going to do something with Eastern Ukraine while we've got this sort of state of flux between Obama and Trump? He's not quite sure how Trump's going to be to work with? Does anybody know how Trump's going to be to work with? So is he, you know, what, they've got this a bit of a lame duck president at the moment, and there's this sort of strange period in the United States. We have two presidents or no presidents at all, then maybe he'll do something. What is it? Just build up to 55,000 this week. Why? Why would you do such a thing? Just very briefly looking at that map, look at the river systems there through Kiev. Ukraine definitely divides geographically into east and west, and the way the peoples are, the makeup of the peoples, there's a lot of Russian sympathisers on the east of Ukraine. So he may well go in there, but the point I'm making is, large army, big military build-up, they're doing it there. They're also doing it on the borders of the Baltic states as well, and they're moving stuff towards the Med and to Syria. So who can deny that activity? And little phrase in verse 7, just a little phrase there. Be thou prepared and prepare for thyself. And that word prepare, you know, we haven't got a time to look at it today, but it's in Joel chapter 3, big time. Joel chapter 3, which is prophecy of time there, the word prepare is there, prominent word. Same word here. And I'm just going to show you one graph. Doesn't matter if you can't read the figures or anything, you can see the direction of the graph. And that's Russia's military expenditure in millions of current US dollars, 93 to 2013, and it's gone up even further since 2013. The percentage of the gross national product of Russia going into military hardware is really high. I think I heard something recently, something like 25%. It's just incredible. And this is a country that basically is poor. The average man and a woman in Russia has got nothing, really. You know, there's a small percentage. It's so often is the case with countries across the world. You've got very few, got a lot, but the majority of Russians, nothing. And everything's been put into the military, one way or another. And look at that graph. You know, this is down here, 2005. Just look at how it's gone since 10 years ago. And the graph does start from naught. I always have to check that. It starts from naught. So you can see that upward growth. That's what he's doing. Well, why do you do that if you don't use it? Be thou prepared. They really are preparing. Sign number 6. And in that preparation, to show you a map of Crimea, which they took a couple of years back, the West moaned and groaned. And there was a few sanctions or two applied, which makes it difficult for the Russians. But it's incredible for all the sanctions upon the Russian peoples. Putin is a very, very popular man. The common folk, even though they've been rags and they live under corrugated iron, they love him because he's a strong man. They love a strong man, and they put up with hardship for the glory of Russia, for the esteem that he brings to the nation. And why was Crimea so important? Same reason as it was basically in the Crimean War of the 1850s. The Russians want to have a fleet in the Black Sea. They want to dominate that area of the Black Sea and out into the Mediterranean through that means. So Sevastopol was a real important place for them. And they made that a port. The ships that came through the English Channel recently were all going that way. And whilst Sevastopol's there in the Black Sea, Crimea, critical. Why they're interested in Syria? Because they want a seaboard there, they want a port in the Med, which is Tartus. And this has just happened, literally just happened. You know, 2 years ago, we wouldn't be talking about this. There's a problem with Tartus, though. You're not going to see it from that photograph. But the quays and so on are not big enough for their ships. So what's Russia doing? Pouring loads and loads of money in. You know, this is a country with war, awful war, but they're putting money in to get those quays right, to get that port right for their ships. And well, you can just see before I move off that map, they've now got a presence in the Black Sea, they've now got a presence in the Med. There they are, to the north of Israel. I just put that Latakia, I don't know how we pronounce it, I put that up because that's a big Russian air base as well. So the Russians at the moment are really interested in having a measure of control on eastern Syria. And they're not too bothered about western Syria, but they want access to that coastline and they want a measure of control on that eastern side, which up to recently, Assad, the leader of their regimes, were really struggling with all Syria, but I guess that eastern part is the most precious to him and to the Russians, so they're really making a big effort there. They want that secure. They might come to some sort of peace agreement. Syria might even get carved up. Hard to see that as we speak today, when the regime seems to be winning. They seem to be winning Aleppo. The war seems to be turning in their favour. So who knows, but the Russians are there and they're not going to move away. They want that port, they're going to keep that port. And then we come down to verse 5, or perhaps it's back up to verse 5, and we have three other nations there confederate with them: Persia, Ethiopia, and Libya. And we've known about these three for a long time, haven't we? But let's not be too dismissive. In my youth, Persia, or modern day Iran, was very much in the Western camp. Very much so. In 1979, with that revolution, bloody revolution, it's the Ayatollah Khomeini and so on. And although there's been changes recently in Iran, there's even been some sort of olive branches extended one to another between Iran and the United States. Rouhani, the leader of Iran, is very much in the Russian camp. So this is just last August. So the Persians are in line. Sign number 7. You'd have a job to identify Persia in the 1900s, by the way, but that's me going backwards too far. Ethiopia, we've got to be careful with Ethiopia, because in modern day terms, we're talking about Sudan, southern Sudan, which is a fearful area, and it's not a great place to be. Probably the worst place on the planet, actually. But, amazingly, Russians have been talking to them, and they're friendly, and the Russians certainly want an influence there. And although it's hard to see any military benefit for the Ethiopians being with them, but those of Sudan being with them, they're certainly leaning towards Russia for support, and Russia's all too willing to give it. They'll give it to anybody. So that's number 8. Libya, again, fascinating what's been happening there in recent times. Libya, after the Second World War, pro-Western with the oil and everything else, very much pro-Western. And then with Gaddafi, remember him? What a maverick sort of character he was. Hated by the Arabs, hated by everybody. And then Reagan chooses to make him the big target. And when it comes to terrorist action and the Lockerbie disaster, remember the terrible thing there that where the plane came down? It looks like now that the Syrians were at the heart of that, but Reagan and the American administration put the blame on Gaddafi, and Gaddafi surprised and said, "Thank you, I'll take that, I'll have that," in the hope that all the Arabs will rally around him, and he played to it. Well, he had anything to do with it, it's very much in doubt, but they all went for him. And Gaddafi became a real big friend of Putin. They had quite a few conversations about gas pipelines, oil pipelines. They made agreements, big friends. And then you know what happened in the Arab Spring? Gaddafi gets kicked out. He gets kicked out because the West support those rising against him. And Britain got heavily involved with the French. Britain and the French more than the Americans at the finish. But where are we now? Where are we now? We're in a state of flux. Libya, does anybody know the leader of Libya? It's really difficult. Really difficult. Who's in control? You may not have seen this man's face too much, but he seems to be the one that's at the top at the moment. Actually got American connections. I think he was born in America, but he's going to Moscow. I put that up, when I wrote this a few weeks back, that was his visit to Moscow in June. But I didn't have time this morning, but I looked up this morning, went last week. So he was talking to Putin last week again. And it's about getting arms deals. It's about making sure this man's got control on Libya, because it's absolutely in turmoil. It's a real mess. And what appeared to be a success for Cameron, British government and the French, is not quite so often talked about in those terms now. And it seems to me that Libya is leaning that way again. Putin wants those deals that he had with Gaddafi, those pipelines, all that. He wants that made secure. And I guess he's looking to this guy to do it, this strong man to do it. So that's sign number 9. Be thou a guard to them, says the Lord of Gog. To all those in Confederate, those your allies, be a guard to them. And there's lots of ways we could demonstrate this. I'll just do it with one diagram. Just this year, the Russians have taken the opportunity to use that platform they've got in Syria to put missiles in there. And that's the range that their missiles can go now. And so they can actually go into Israeli airspace. Before, Israel always had command of the skies, but they haven't got total command now. They've got to be very mindful of what the Russians may not do. So the Triumph missiles is designed to protect critical infrastructure, blah, blah, blah. It's there first and foremost for Russian interests, but at the moment it's in the guise to protect the Syrian regime. So that's number 10. We see them guarding. We see them protecting. They actually talk in terms of protecting their people. And they'll go into the Crimea. They're doing to help the Russian ethnic people that are really getting oppressed there. They talk in those terms. We're going as a guard. We're not oppressors. We're deliverers. Right. Now this one's perhaps more challenging for us. Go right back to verse 2. There's linked may go with Russia and... I could look at Mago in terms of identifier with Russia, but are these people described by this term, are those northern tribes are going to Russia as well? They spread out more to the west and go towards Germany. So there are quite a few biblical scholars, not just Christadelphians, I hasten to add, not just Christadelphians. You go and listen to some of the other people talking about Ezekiel 38, as I've done this last week. They say much the same. They have all sorts of other false doctrines, sadly, but they say much the same as us. And amongst them, there is of the opinion that possibly Germany's involved when we look at Magog. This is from the leading art journal in Germany, and this is 2 years ago now and more. Where do we stand when it comes to Russia? And relatedly, who are we as Germans with the threat of a new East-West conflict? This question has regained prominence in Germany and may ultimately force us to reposition ourselves. And if you hang on a minute, reposition ourselves, there wouldn't be a Germany if it wasn't for the Marshall Plan, if it wasn't for the Americans pumping millions of dollars in after the Second World War, when Germany was just a heap, absolute heap. Western Germany, within a handful of years, rose up. Why? Because they had all that money pumped in by the Americans, all that military protection from NATO, which includes the Brits, all that there, all that protection against the Soviet Union, the division of West and East, and so all that. And they're talking about ultimately force us to reposition ourselves. So are they repositioning themselves? Are they now leaning more to the east than they do to the west? Well, Merkel wants Moscow to get closer to the European Economic Area, as she says, step by step. She actually wants close ties with Russia. They want economic links there. And do you remember a few years back, I've forgotten the name now, but there was that terrible earthquake, tsunami and so on in Japan. And as a result of that, obviously big problems in Japan about their energy and how they're going to deal with their energy, the own nuclear and so on. And the Germans reacting to that, Merkel reacting to that, decided then, we're not going that way as a country. We're not going to go that route. I mean, Britain's recently decided that we will. We're not going to do that. The French have got quite a few power stations of that ilk, but no, we're not doing that. We're going to go best we can, renewables, but we'll have to use gas and the Russian pipelines. The Russian supply of gas becomes more important than ever. So you get something happens in Japan, affects Germans' reaction to how they deal with the Russians. You know, there's all this going off. And don't forget, Merkel, surprisingly, was brought up as an East German. So she'll know her Russian very well. And you'd think that she'd be anti-Russian as a result of being brought up in East Germany. But no! She actually gets on well with Mr. Putin. And although they're not altogether at one over the Ukraine, when it came to sanctions against Russia over the Ukraine, who's the one that was pushing it? The one who was pushing it was Cameron. It was the French and the Germans that were, we don't want to really, you know, are we going to do... And Cameron said, we've got to do something. We've got to put pressure on Russia. This is not acceptable, what they've done in the Crimea. And amazingly, Cameron had an influence on the likes of Merkel, and the sanctions came in. But now Cameron's gone. There's a whole different situation now in Europe. And so conversations between Merkel and Putin can happen far more easily without anybody sticking an oar in from a British point of view or from a pro-Western point of view. Sign 11. And that leads me on to Gomer, because if Magog is challenging this one, I haven't put as a sign because it's more debatable. But those of us that were here last night would have noticed, I hope, through the many quotations, there was a quotation where Brother Thomas actually talks about France being of Gomer. Did he notice that? Made me sit up. I hadn't noticed that before. Because there is a view that Gomer could well be talking of France in our day and generation. And there's Gomer in verse 6, whoever they are, and all his bands. So why do I say that? Because, you know, we have three-way conversations these days. And there's no Cameron anymore, or Theresa May making the fourth party. They don't have to be there. So they meet in Moscow, they meet in Paris, they meet in Berlin, and they've done this year. They're talking. Despite the problems in the Crimea, they're talking. And the French haven't got a great love for the Jews at the moment. In fact, there's a lot of Jews in France seeking to leave the country. A lot of Jews are fearful in France because the French are so very, very frightened of the Muslim influence they've got. And they're scared of the situation. And all these refugees that are coming in, France is not handling it really well. And the Jews in France are scared. But I won't get to digress too much. Let's go on to Togomar. And I was really interested in Brother Stephen's comments on Togomar last night. Because this is Turkey. Something I've been thinking about quite a bit in the last couple of months. And the president of Turkey, what a year he's had with revolution, puts it down. Before that, Turks shot down a Russian plane, got on top water. Oh, lots going on. And he made some sort of agreement with refugees, do you remember, with the West, but it's in the hope that Turkey could join the EU. So he's got a bit of a bargaining chip with the refugees. But only this last week they've fallen out, the West, with Turkey. So what does he say only this last week? Some may criticise me, but I express my opinion. For example, I've said, why shouldn't Turkey be in the Shanghai Five? And you might say, what the heck's the Shanghai Five? Well, the Shanghai Five is an organisation, loose security and economic bloc, led by Russia and China, with the three stands. And what he's saying is, if you're not going to help us, the West, if we're not going to be allowed into the European Union, if we're not going to get economic support there, then we'll go the other way. And despite the problems that Turkey's had with Russia, they're trying to patch it all up. It got really hot for them earlier on with that revolution and so on, probably fermented by the Russians. So it's trying to smooth it all over. He's gone to Moscow and so on. He's talked to Putin. And now he's talking about maybe entering the Shanghai Five. Here we've got Togomar, the North country, started to move, it seems to me, under the influence of Russia. They may not be occupied by Russia, they may not be a satellite of Russia, but they come under the influence of Russia. And the West seems relatively powerless to do anything about it. Although it was mentioned last night, quite rightly, that Trump's got quite a few bits of property in Istanbul, so I guess he'd be interested. Although he says he's got no interest in these commercial activities anymore. Didn't notice that, made me laugh, that did. Sheba indeed, Dan. I'm conscious of the time, so I'm going to go real quick. I hope you can read that bottom comment on that display there. The English isn't very good, but my Arabic is even worse. We're talking here of Saudi Arabia, the Sunnis, in opposition with the Shiites, who are headed up by Iran. So you've got Iran with a power block of Arabs, which is basically Shiite. You've got the Saudis, who are a power block basically of Sunnis, and they don't get on with each other. And that, to me, says it all. They just don't get on. And again, overwhelming, you look, Sheba indeed, people point to Saudi Arabia, sign 13, down the right side of the fence, for all their violations of human rights, for all those violations, they're all overlooked by the West. We've got to sell them arms, we've got to be friendly with them, with the oil, etc. We need our influence in the Middle East. So for all their violations, forget that, human rights, forget it. Just, let's deal with them. So on the right side, and then we come down to the Young Lions, don't we? Merchants of Tarshish and the Young Lions. I'm not going to go through all these, but to me, and I've really looked at this hard this year, been on the fence too long, but I think I've come off the fence now. There's seven factors which seem to me to indicate that indeed Tarshish is the English-speaking peoples, the Brits, Commonwealth, yeah, but obviously it's the United States primarily. But they all come from the Tarshish folk. Sign 14. So this is 14 things to think about. There's the blocks I'm talking about. I put the bold rectangles with those that are key to it. So those that are with Gog, those who offer some sort of resistance, even only be words, the merchants of Tarshish, there we go, in blue. Israel's caught in the middle. And we come down to 13. The question is, aren't they come to take a spoil? So what's Israel got that's worth having? Exactly the same, really, as what Libya had. I mean, why would anyone want to talk to a madman like Gaddafi? Come on, who would want to be friends with someone like Gaddafi? But you try and get friendly with Gaddafi because you want pipelines with gas and oil, petrol, because it's money, it's wealth, it's influence, it's power. So Israel was suddenly, recent times, brothers and sisters, recent times, It's discovered oil. It used to be, we're our Dunbar. All our Arab enemies have got oil. We've got nothing. Well, they have got it now. They've discovered it now. And it changes the whole scene, doesn't it? There is a spoil. And Israel's precious in other ways as well, in their technology, but that's perhaps less tangible to take away. Verse 10, we read of Gog. Thou shalt have an evil thought. What's the evil thought? Well, at the moment, the Russian economy, as I've described, is in a shambles. The oil price has gone up last week, and they'll do much better for it. We'll do worse for it, and we're afraid we're going to be paying more for petrol soon. So they put the oil price up, but they're economically in the mess. So what do you do when you're economically in the mess? You go outward, get people's mind on other stuff. Social unrest, if there's any at all. Foreign policy, bring it to bear. So, you know, we've got possibilities there why they should go into Israel. But it's not a sign as yet. It hasn't happened yet. And we certainly haven't seen this. In the words of verse 11, Israel is supposed to be at peace. But this is really odd. I don't know if you're aware of this. This is really odd. Putin and Netanyahu get on. They actually like each other. A couple of years ago, when Putin started to move stuff towards Syria, Netanyahu got on a plane to Moscow. And I wasn't surprised at that. I don't know what they said behind closed doors, but my imagination says it might have gone something like this. What are you doing? You can't put your stuff down near us. We're not happy with that. In fact, we know he said that. He went there to say that, to complain to the Russians. Don't get involved in the Middle East. It's enough going on as it is. But I think behind closed doors, after Netanyahu had those strong words, Putin told him, come on, look at it in the real world here. You're just little Israel. I've got all this military might and all the will. Come on, I can put my stuff where I want to put my stuff. I can wage war when I wage war. And then with that clash, other things were said. And this is where I'm guessing a bit. I reckon Putin has said things to Netanyahu like, we'll sort out Hezbollah, we'll get security in Syria, we'll get it to settle down, and it will go nice and quiet, and everything will be fine. Well, whatever it is, they're friendly. Apparently Putin was brought up by Jews. He had a rough time as a boy, and the neighbouring family were Jews, and they helped his family in his bringing up, so he's got sympathies towards the Jews, which again is so surprising. But this could lull Israel into a sense of security that they have not. There was talk recently that the Russian and the Israeli Air Force have exchanged passwords and codes and so on, so they can control the airspace between them. Now you think, what's going on there? What? You might expect it, the RAF with the United States, or even with the Israel. This is Russia and Israelis trading sensitive information like that so they don't clash over the skies over Syria and so on. I won't read that out, but someone made that comment earlier this year that their relationship is complicated. It certainly is more complicated than I thought it would be. Sign 16, and we'll go very quickly over this one. So we're waiting for that to happen, and of course this may be that Christ has come, judgment's taken place, because we know the saints are with the Lord when it comes to intervene at that great battle. So maybe it's not a sign for us ever to witness this side of immortality. But the last sign, verse 20, and we've got to the end of Ezekiel 38. I'm sure you're aware of it, but the last part of Ezekiel 30, as you go down, it's all about earthquake, huge earthquake, great shaking. And there's been some reports made on behalf of the Knesset about the potential of earthquake in Israel and in Jerusalem in particular. And there are two recent quotations. Now, if that isn't a sign, I don't know what it is, that's another one. And we all know, don't we, about the plates and how they all link up. But you've got that real fault line right there, running through Jerusalem. So if there's an earthquake there, it triggers the whole thing off worldwide. We know of it. We're fortunate to know of that sign 17. We are living in exciting, momentous times. We need to be watching, as Brother Stephen said yesterday. We need to be aware of God's view of the world and prayerfully be reading his word. And we need to ensure that we're separating ourselves from the world and that which is not pleasing, and that we're right with God. Because everything is heralding the appointed day. And surely, brothers and sisters, we long for that day of righteousness.